It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, research shows that happy cows make more milk and dairy farmers are changing up their barns because of it. We'll find out about cool air misting and bovine back scratching in a bit. First, today, Jared Kushner appeared before the Senate Intelligence Committee in a closed-door meeting about his contacts with Russian officials. President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law released written remarks before the meeting denying any improper contacts or collusion. Here's a clip of Kushner giving a statement after his meeting today.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so. I had no improper contacts. I have not relied on Russian funds for my businesses. And I have been fully transparent in providing all requested information.
Kyle Chaney is with us now. He's a congressional reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, Kyle, that testimony was originally scheduled at a public meeting that was supposed to air on Wednesday and occur on Wednesday. Why did it get moved to this closed-door session today?
Actually, Kushner had been scheduled to be closed-door. I think Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr. Are scheduled on Wednesday, and they were going to be public. That was moved to closed-door as well. I think this is just it's all part of the back-and-forth negotiation that goes on. We bring in these high-level officials. Especially an executive branch official like Kushner, they don't want to just to go in and make it a big spectacle, at least at the initial questioning here. I think what we're seeing, though, is the beginning of something of questions for Kushner, not necessarily the end of his time here.
He did release remarks, I think some 11 pages before he went and answered questions today. What do we know about what was in those pages?
So you heard it a little bit in his statement, which was a very adamant and clear claim that I had no improper contacts with anyone from Russia. I did not collude with Russia to do what he didn't quite say. And then he mentioned that he didn't have any Russian funding or didn't rely on Russian funds for his business, which has been a question about whether any relationships there, loans or financing, may have been one mechanism of influence.
Is this par for the course, releasing a statement like this before someone goes in for questioning so that the senators or representatives kind of know what the arguments are going to be going in?
I think it does actually help those members and those staffers who do the questioning. It's not necessarily par for the course, especially for a closed hearing where you don't usually hear from the witness at all. It sort of frames the argument. And Jim Comey, the former FBI director, did something very similar
before his
public hearing, laid out all the facts, and it really helped members move right into the questioning as opposed to having to rehash all of the backstory.
Now, Kushner said he had several meetings with Russian officials, and he went through those. What do we know, based on what happened today in his statement, what do we know about the substance of those meetings?
Well, according to Kushner, the substance was, for the most part, innocuous. The one that's still going to raise a lot of questions is the one where he essentially agreed to set up a communications channel with the Kremlin to talk about what he says is to talk about strategy in Syria. He confirmed a lot of reporting that's been out there on him already about the reports that said he tried to establish a back channel with Russia, him and Lieutenant General Flynn, the Trump's former national security advisor. What the details are around that are still very murky. Why he agreed to do that, why Flynn, Kushner's argument is I'm kind of inexperienced, I didn't know that might be off color, but Flynn didn't necessarily intervene either. So still a lot of lingering questions that we don't know what he told the committee about that.
In his own defense, in the statement at least, it sounds like he reported that this was a one-time thing and it wasn't intended to be an ongoing back channel.
Right, and that was sort of a new marginal change difference from what we'd heard before, only in the reports. He's really minimizing any contact that he had, very innocuous, one-off, kind of almost incidental, people reached out to him, he kind of agreed because he felt obligated type of meetings that he had.
And did Kushner address the fact that his security clearance application didn't include any of these meetings?
He did talk about that a bit. He claims in his statement that these were, it was an inadvertent, an aide assistant sent along his forms before they had finalized the foreign contact section, and that there was no intent there to deceive. And then as they compiled the fuller list, they turned that over to investigators. That's still a point of contention. I think people wonder, these forms are very clear. If you mislead or omit, it can be a serious problem to lose your clearance.
Talking with Kyle Chaney right now, congressional reporter for Politico, joining us to talk about Jared Kushner's appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee today in a closed-door session. And you were talking about lingering questions, Kyle, and among those, there has been this June 16th meeting with a Russian lawyer that wasn't reported until a year later. Did we get any new information or insight on that meeting?
Well, very limited from what's come out of the actual hearing, that they're very tight-lipped about that. But in his statement, he did speak to that and said, look, I had no idea what the substance of this meeting was. It was something my brother-in-law, Don Jr., arranged, and I, as a courtesy, attended the meeting that he asked me to attend. And he said he got his secretary to call him mid-meeting to get out of it just because he didn't feel like sitting there any longer. So, again, really downplaying, minimizing his involvement here kind of pushes that more back towards Donald Trump Jr. and you know, whatever his answers are about that meeting.
And another kind of big picture question here is what, if anything, Kushner knew about Russian attempts to influence the presidential election. I know that the senators on the Intelligence Committee and also in the House are going to be trying to get a complete picture there. Any new light there?
No, I mean, I think what you're hearing from mostly from Trump administration officials is, look, you know, the president won't even agree with his intelligence community's assessment on this. And the other officials essentially say, we didn't know anything about it. It didn't involve us. This Donald Trump Jr. meeting that cast everything in a new light about what the mentality was among some campaign officials. But at the same time, no one is suggesting that they were aware of some grand plan that the intelligence community says Russia and then Vladimir Putin were up to.
Now, you mentioned that this is not going to be the last time that Jared Kushner is going to be answering questions. He's got an appearance before the House Intelligence Committee as well. What else are you looking for as some more of these meetings and question and answer sessions come up?
Well, the big question. Unfortunately, we don't get to sit in on these, and they're very hush about the proceedings. So the question will be: Do Kushner's stories and the stories of other witnesses coming forward, like Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr., do they line up? Do they match each other's stories? They were all parties to this June meeting that you mentioned. They were all high-level campaign officials, and now Kushner himself in the White House. So investigators have a chance to really push them on some of the nuances and details that we haven't always been privy to.
And their reaction, you said it's been very hush-hush, but have you heard any kind of reaction from the Senate Intelligence Committee or anyone else, you know, on the Hill reacting to this testimony today?
Right now, there's been none. Kushner himself, the only one who's come out and given any sort of statement, and he told reporters he thought the meeting went great, I think was his exact word. So it seems like he was feeling fairly confident. His statements to the press was very parsed, was very exact, and clearly was vetted. So there hasn't been any impromptu questioning of him or so far any of the senators that participated in the hearing.
Kyle, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter for Politico, and he joined us there to talk about Jared Kushner's appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee today in a closed-door session. Coming up, he'll also be answering questions from the House Intelligence Committee. Right now, Wisconsin's milk production is at an all-time high, and some of that might be due to happy cows. Stress-free cows tend to make more milk. And UW-Madison's Dairyland Initiative is helping farmers around the state design their barns in a way that keeps their animals happy and productive. Nigel Cook joins us now. He's a professor in food animal production medicine and chair of the Department of Medical Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. Nigel, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us, Marika Pennerman. She's a U.S. champion cheesemaker from Thorpe, Wisconsin, and she's also the first woman to win the Wisconsin Outstanding Young Farmer Award. Marika, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me, too.
Nigel, let's start with you. You're head of a UW project called the Dairyland Initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is and what your goals are with it?
Sure. It really came out of a history of our group here in the School of Veterinary Medicine working with farmers in the state, trying to help them solve problems. And we came to a realization that our housing recommendations 10-plus years ago weren't as they should be, and we were seeing some issues related to what was happening in our state. So we developed an online resource, a training program through a series of workshops and through our own herd consultations directly with farmers, basically wanting to make available the best possible resources and information for all of our producers to build better facilities for dairy cattle.
How long have we known, I mean, it makes sense, but how long have we known that this is true, that happy cows produce more milk?
I think we've always aspired to keeping our cows happy, but I'm not sure we've done sufficient research or looked at our cows enough to know what exactly makes them happy. And so I think our efforts and the efforts of colleagues over the last 10 years have done exactly that. We've asked the cow more about what she needs, and when she's told us what she wants, we've really got a great group of producers out there that have been willing to take our information, put it in place, and see the results.
You said you've asked the cow what she needs. Can you tell us more about what that means and how you ask a cow what she needs?
Yeah, we've put video cameras up. We've tracked dry matter intakes. We've tracked health records, developed metrics to track milk production, and monitored health things like lameness, and made associations and done a lot of behavioral-based research to sort of design the facility around the cow and what she needs to maximize resting time, to optimize intakes, and ultimately lead to a happy cow that's also a healthy and productive one for the farmer.
And Marika, I want to turn to you now. At your farm, I understand you make cow happiness a top priority. Can you take us inside your barn and tell us what you do that keeps your cows calm and content?
Yes, I always call our cows our good at cows because they help us produce. We ask them to produce a very high quality of milk, to produce a very high quality of Gouda cheese. So it's for our best interest also to have the right conditions for the cows. We offer tours for people to come and look at the cows. And we always say we have a cow spa. So all the things, the barn is completely designed for the well comfort of the cow. You can farm in many, many different ways. I always say a farmer put in a lot of hours, and you can farm, and you have to farm in a way that fits your way of living. So you have organic and you have GMO-free grass-fed cows. And I can always speak. I can only speak from how we farm. We have a freestyle barn. That means that the cows walk around freely in our barn. We have four lactating groups, and then we have two groups that are our maternity leave cows, so they are dry cows. We have sand bedding. Sand bedding. It's like us laying on the beach, I always say.
Wow.
And it is just very comfortable. Not all farms are suitable to do it, but when we started building at this current location about 3-4 years ago, for us, sand bedding was very essential, was very high on our list. We have ventilators because when we ask them to produce a high quality of milk, they produce all this warmth around the cow. And if the cow cannot get rid of the warmth, then the cow is not comfortable. So a cow drinks a bathtub of water. And often people ask me, why are your cows not going outside? Well, we think we can take better care of them by having them inside. We do not have the circumstances to have the cow outside because, again, when they produce the milk, they have all that heat around them. If there's not enough trees or if there is not enough shade around, then it's nice for us to look at the cow, but it's not always nice for the cow to be outside. Also, if they have to walk a very long distance for water, that's not for the well-being of the cow either. And there are farms that have those circumstances, but we don't have that. So we have our cows inside where they have shade, where they have sand bedding, they have a ventilator. We have cow brushes. The cow brushes are very phenomenal, too.
Is that for scratching the cow's back?
Yes, yes. As soon as the cow touches the cow brush, it starts rotating, so it is also energy saving. But the cow touches it, and it goes for the whole thing. It starts by the head, and it ends by the butt, or the other way around. it's again for the cow to feel well, and it also keeps the cow cleaner, and that helps for us for the quality of the milk also.
We're talking right now with Marika Pennerman, a U.S. champion cheesemaker from Thorp, Wisconsin, also the first woman to win the Wisconsin Outstanding Young Farmer Award. Also with us is Nigel Cook, a professor in food animal production medicine and chair of the Department of Medical Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. And Nigel, we just heard all about what Marika does with her cows to keep them happy. A lot of things going on there. Sand bedding, ventilators, the right temperatures, back scratchers that kind of give the cows a head-to-toe little back scratch there. Does that sound about right? What else would you add to the list?
I think that's great. I think you have to remember that our cows are metabolic athletes, so they need to be pampered if they're going to perform like Olympic champions. So sand bedding to conform to their bodies as they lie down, so they get to rest for 12 hours a day, cooling because they have a large fermentation vat. They get heat stress before humans do, so we have to be conscious of that. So fast-moving air, cooling air, sufficient bunk space, making sure that the cows can all have access to the fresh feed as it's delivered. So making sure all the cows can eat at the same time, because we have to remember that even though a lot of the times we're keeping them in housing, indoors, they're herd creatures, and they like to do the same things at the same time. They like to be in socially stable groups, so our industry's worked really hard these last few years of keeping groups together so that the animals don't have to do what I call the meet and greet all the time. They can create these very stable groups where they recognize each other, leads to a more calm, predictable environment. Cows like predictability. They like things to be the same. And making sure we're bringing plenty of clean, fresh air and cool air into the barn. Those are, you know, really what we refer to as biological standards. 10 years ago, we made sure that the roof didn't collapse when the snow came down. Now we're smarter than that. We're building the barn around the cow, giving her what she needs. And as Marika says, that a lot of people still expect our cows to graze, and that's very nice some of the time. But when it's pouring with rain or blistering hot, when the land is wet like it is now after these storms, it's pretty nice to develop an environment that we have a little more control over, where the cow can continue to rest and eat and be comfortable and be given the spa treatment.
Nigel, do you remember, I don't know how many years it was ago, but there was some ad from California saying Californian cows were happier than Wisconsin. I mean, the implication was then, you know, Wisconsin cows, and so the product there was better. I mean, is there something to that? Are cows happier in California because the climate is nicer, or are Wisconsin cows more miserable because they got to live through rain and snow and sleet?
The environment is definitely different, and so I'd say it's actually a little easier to dairy cows in California than it can be in a Wisconsin winter. But we can create, you know, you have to remember, cows are tremendously adaptable. They're not, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all. You don't have to keep cows in one particular circumstance. They will adapt and do great things, and we've got large freestall facilities where we can give them shade, give them comfort, and the cows do extremely well in those environments. At the same time, we've got grazing herds that also do a terrific job, and where the land is great and the climate is good, then that's exactly what we should do with cows. But we shouldn't look at those different systems as one precluding the other. I think we can adapt to the cow and give her the environment she needs.
Marika, your signature cheese, it's called Marika Gouda, is made just hours after your cows get milked. How important is the character, I guess, of that milk to getting the cheese just right? And do you think, you know, that you would be able to get that same quality without everything you do to make sure that your cows feel good?
No, I think that if the cow doesn't feel good, you will taste it right away in the milk. So for us, it's very important to make sure that our ladies are taken well care of. And I always say, too, it's not, well, the cold weather. Well, it's the heat that they are struggling the most with. I always say in the winter, it's not the cow that is cold, it's the farmer. And my husband heard me say that one time to a group, and he laughed. It's not the farmer, it's the farmer's wife. And he's kind of right about that. But no, for us, it's very important. And I think having the milk straight from the cows, we actually, when the cows get milk, we have a pipeline that goes straight into our production room here at the cheese. So we actually don't cool down the milk, and the transportation of the milk is very minimized. So the high quality of milk that the cows are producing, you can taste that right away. I think the freshness and being well taken care of the cows, that helps.
Marika, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Nigel, appreciate you being on with us too.
Great, thank you.
That was Marika Penderman, a U.S. champion cheesemaker from Thorp, Wisconsin, and also Nigel Cook there with us, a professor in food animal production medicine and chair in the Department of Medical Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine at UW-Madison. And they were both with us to talk about why happy cows make more milk and also what it takes to make cows happy. First, for months now, critics inside and outside the Democratic Party have been saying it's high time for Dems to figure out their core message. Even before Clinton's loss in November, there were rumblings about Trump's direct Make America First, Make America Great Again message, in contrast with Hillary Clinton's more candidate-focused slogan. Her slogan was, I'm with her. And now Democrats are out of power in the White House and Congress, but that doesn't mean it's been easy going for Republicans, with major failures to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act and the ongoing Russia investigation. With the 2018 midterm elections coming up, Democrats are preparing to unveil a new messaging and policy platform called A Better Deal. Graham Vise joins us now. He's a staff writer covering politics for the New Republic. Graham, thanks for joining us.
Veronica, thanks for having me.
Well, in a recent Washington Post ABC News poll, it says 37% of Americans said that the Democratic Party currently stands for something, while 52% said, quote, it just stands against Trump. So why have Democrats, do you think, had a tough time with messaging in the last year or so?
Well, I think you're right that one of the main criticisms of Hillary Clinton's campaign last year was that she focused too much of her energy and messaging on attacking Donald Trump and not offering what these critics call a clear contrast with him and a more populist economic message to compete with his. But now, heading up into the midterm elections, you know, the Democrats have come out with this new agenda, which they released today on, it's called A Better Deal, focusing on better jobs, better wages, and a better future. And it does have more of an economic populist flavor of the sort you'd expect maybe from Bernie Sanders or the sort of Elizabeth Warren wing of the party. So it's being, I think, fairly well received from some of the people who were critical of the party following the Trump election.
You wrote a piece about this before the plan came out, and you were among the questions on the table. You were musing about whether Democrats would pick as a focal point the Russia investigation or whether they would pick health care, because those seemed like sort of the biggest stories in the room then. It turns out they didn't really pick either one of them with a better deal.
I was struck by that, too. Yeah, no. I mean, for months, there was a piece in Politico in May, and the Associated Press had a story just last week where it seemed like the tug of war was between those two, you know, issues. And I argued that, you know, it didn't much make sense for the party to focus on, you know, just one issue or to sort of invest in one big slogan in terms of their messaging. But it does appear that this better deal agenda includes, you know, a variety of policies from, you know, prescription drug price gouging, you know, working to combat that. There's an interesting new focus on antitrust laws, where they want to fight to allow regulators to break up big companies that they say are hurting consumers and making it harder to you know, for companies to merge, if it's going to reduce competition. You know, they reaffirmed their support for lifting the minimum wage to $15 and so support for public infrastructure and policies along those lines, paid family leave. So it's a pretty comprehensive agenda, which does not focus specifically on, you know, one issue like healthcare or, you know, Donald Trump's various Russia scandals.
Is it intended to hearken back to the New Deal and evoke that? Are there other underlying messages or resonances that you hear in it?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I was thinking that certainly the New Deal is a touchstone. Also, perhaps a response to the President Trump's famous art of the deal, you know, and the idea that maybe, you know, that's his slogan or his mantra. And so the Democrats are going to say, well, our deal is better. But again, I mean, one of the points I made in my piece that I think it's hard to argue based on history that a simple slogan or sort of piece of rhetoric is going to be the deciding or galvanizing factor for Democrats in 2018. However, there is some history that suggests that, you know, offering a policy agenda and sort of, you know, making promises about what you'll do when you retake control of Congress could, you know, could be effective. And so that it sounds like that's what they're doing.
On the other hand, you say in your piece that they might not really need a message because it seems that if history is any judge, it might be enough just to say, hey, we're better than those folks in power. We can do a better job. And maybe they don't need the messaging underlying it just yet.
Right. I mean, this is, as you can imagine, a controversial idea to put forward, even if you're simply, you know, doing analysis of, you know, recent political history, because no Democrat, particularly, you know, those who are frustrated by, you know, the Hillary Clinton's loss and this idea that she didn't have, you know, enough of a solid competitive message, wants to hear that the party, you know, just should simply oppose Trump. And I think moving forward, you know, as the party looks to 2020 and the presidential race, there is no question that they're going to need strong messaging that sort of sets them apart from the president. What I did say in my piece is that historically, big national midterm messaging tends not to matter for the party that's out of power. So these elections, midterms, tend to be referendum on the party that controls Congress, and that means that 2018 is likely to be a kind of report card for the Republicans, you know, where the Democrats, you know, of course should put forward a message and should, you know, in individual races make, you know, positive cases for their candidacies. But, you know, when you talk to experts who have followed congressional elections over the decades, the consensus seems to be that it tends to be kind of an up or down, yes or no question as to whether you like the job performance of the party in power in Congress.
Talking to Graham Weiss right now, he's a staff writer covering politics for the New Republic, talking about messaging from Democrats. They caught some flack for messaging during the election, and there's been anticipation about what the arguing points would be going forward and looking into the midterm elections. Now, Democrats have a soon-to-be release. There's not a lot of detail out there, but some details that the plan, the policy agenda they have is going to be called a better deal, and Democrats hoping that will carry towards some wins in the 2018 midterms. And Graham, if we look at Make America Great Again, Donald Trump's core message during the presidential election, and what we have now from Democrats, a better deal, you said, you know, kind of contrasts against The Art of the Deal, Trump's book. But does it have kind of that populist underpinning, the sense that maybe everything isn't great right now for everybody? Do you hear that? And is that, do you think, the right message?
Well, I do think that some of the reaction today, when Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, was speaking about and writing about this new message, some of the reaction has been that, you know, he really does sound different about the sort of state of the country and the Democrats' messaging over the past few years. You know, he acknowledged that the Democratic Party Party has sort of failed to convey the sense of economic, frustration or hurt that has pervaded much of the country. And he talked about how the sort of political and economic system has been rigged against Americans, and it's being interpreted as sort of repositioning and a change of tone along those lines. And so I think that you mentioned that there was some of the plan is going to be continued to be rolled out next week and in the future, but there with the various policies that were released today, which I mentioned, I think there was a real sense that this is a new agenda. These are some new ideas that have not been a focal point for Democrats recently. And again, I should emphasize a shift in tone in terms of the economic plight of Americans and the Democratic Party's sort of response to them, which obviously Donald Trump really capitalized on their sort of lack of lack of ability to address that in last year's election.
And the Washington Post just quoted Representative Jeffries from New York, who said that Republicans talk in headlines, Democrats speak in fine print. It's an interesting critique. Do you think there has been something to that over the years?
It's hard to say. I mean, that is sort of the stereotype, right? And I think that's probably true. I mean, for example, Hillary Clinton was famously criticized as being a policy wonk and someone who was really focused on the details of public policy, which many of us think is a positive quality and would have made her a good president. But in terms of campaigning, particularly again in a presidential contest where it's a choice between two candidates running for the White House at the national level, there does need to be a kind of succinct, clear message. I think obviously President Obama was extremely effective with his message of hope and change, and sort of galvanizing and inspirational, message in his two runs. And so, the big question for the party now is, in the post-Obama era, given Clinton's loss, without a popular president or a sort of once-in-a-generation political figure like Barack Obama, carrying the party in these elections, where do they go from here?
Graham Weiss stays with us now. He's a staff writer covering politics for the New Republic. With us right now to talk about messaging from Democrats and the soon-to-be-released Better Deal package from Democratic leaders that they hope will carry those Democrats to wins in the 2018 midterm elections. And we want to know what you think. Do you think Democrats have hit on the right message this time around for voters? If you're a Democrat, does this appeal to you? A better deal. It's called better jobs, better wages, better future. Does that inspire you? And do you think messaging matters? Or is it better to Democrats for Democrats to stake themselves out as an opposition party to the White House, to President Trump? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Graham Weiss stays with us. He's a staff writer covering politics for the New Republic, with us to talk about whether Democrats need a core message for voters in the 2018 midterm elections. They have a core message now. It's being released a little bit now, a little bit in a week or so, and it's called A Better Deal, Better Jobs, Better Wages, Better Future. And we want to know what you think. Do voters know what Democrats stand for? And does it matter if they do or not? Or is it enough to be against President Trump? If you're a Democrat, does this new messaging inspire you? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's take a first caller now. We've got Terry on the line with us in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think your guest hits very much on a good point that Democrats and progressives in general, I guess, and liberals, I guess, have always been faulty in messaging. Republicans have a very good, easy job with worldview messaging. And I think this new package that Democrats have rolled out is just kind of a reiteration and more being embraced by Democrats as a party of what Bernie Sanders has been talking about ever since the last election. And I think Democrats lost this last time around because Hillary Clinton was the right candidate at the wrong time. She was beat by Barack Obama, and Bernie Sanders also probably would have beat her. So the message is still the core of that. We just need to keep pushing that forward.
Terry, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And I want to ask you, Graham, among the other things that Terry brought up, you did speak to some representatives from communications involved with Bernie Sanders. And what you heard was that the message should be Medicare for everybody, single payer, single payer, single payer, and that should be it.
So this is a very interesting component of this. I mean, you know, you mentioned at the top that the healthcare focus that they were considering for 2018 didn't appear in the same way in this Better Deal messaging. You know, I think the way it was discussed over the months was that it was going to be sort of a focus on the opposition or the attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. But for a while now, certainly since the Sanders campaign, you know, liberals and those on the left have argued that this notion of single payer health care, Medicare for all, should be the sort of next wave of Democratic of what Democrats support on health care. And so that was not included in the Better Deal plan today. However, you know, it's very telling. Chuck Schumer says that single payer is on the table. You know, it's something that that's being discussed, which is a sort of clever way of not endorsing the idea, but sort of nodding to the growing number of Democrats, particularly on the left, who are calling for that. I mentioned in my piece that Representative John Conyers in the House, who has over the years introduced a single-payer bill, got a record number of sponsors for this bill. I believe it's now most House Democrats. I'd have to check on that, but who are supporting that legislation. And even in the Senate, it's very telling that several Democrats who may be presidential prospects for 2020 are now talking in the language of Medicare for all. So Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York has come out in favor of it. Even someone like Senator Cory Booker, who has a slightly more moderate reputation, has not quite endorsed it, but is, you know, sort of talking about the advantages of single payer, the advantages of a Medicare for all system. So although it's not yet in this party agenda, and it will definitely face pushback from Blue Dog Democrats, the conservatives in the caucus. I thought it was very interesting that that the Medicare for All movement seems to be growing, and Chuck Schumer is doing nothing to discourage it.
Well, Terry, thanks a lot for your thoughts. Appreciate that. And we're going to move on to Mike. And you're going to have to help me with pronunciation, Mike. Is it Mishicot? Mishicot?
Mishicot.
Mishicot. Great. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
It's right next to Manitowoc.
Oh, I've been there.
So, yeah, I think a message of unity you know, a focus on unity rather than opposition, I think they're the divisive politics that have been hanging around for decades, it seems like now, you know, and I think that the Democrats got a taste of the, you know, what it's like. You know, I think they tried to, the my way or the highway politics creates more enemies than friends, I think, and they could definitely use that. And I'd like to ask about if you could explain maybe who would lose in a single payer Medicare for all type? You know, if that was going to be the health care.
Got it, Mike. Thank you for that question. And I don't know if you're able to get into the intricacies of a single-payer health care grant. But what about his first message saying a better message would be unity? We've had divisive politics. We've had gridlock. I mean, this is kind of a page out of the Barack Obama playbook from 8 years ago. But is there some kick left in that?
It's very interesting that he mentions this notion of unity and kind of a politics that works for everyone. Because although that was certainly effective for Barack Obama and obviously for all of us who are Americans on some level, we hope that we can have a politics that helps everyone, right? But one of the things about this new messaging and about the moment that we're in politics right now is that progressives want the Democratic Party to talk about who they see as the villains in sort of American life, whether it's Wall Street or the forces that are creating inequality. And so I think this messaging and this sort of sharper, more economic populist tone is not going to be about unity, certainly in the same way that that the Obama rhetoric was. I mean, this is going to be about calling out big corporations and calling out Wall Street when appropriate. And I think there's this, I just before we went on the air, I was seeing a statement from a progressive group that was sort of applauding this notion that the party seems to be moving in the direction of sort of naming those villains that liberals see. It'll be interesting how that plays out, because as your caller points out, there will be people who will say it's divisive, right? It's a sort of class warfare politics. It's a way of dividing the country as opposed to focusing on a more unifying message of opportunity for all. And it's just not where the national politics on either side appear to be right now.
And Graham, we just have a sliver of time left here with you, but do you think Democrats have anything to lose by going full throttle for this new messaging and letting up, perhaps, on President Trump and maybe stepping back from being that full-on opposition party?
Right. I don't think there's any chance that any Democratic candidate is going to be letting up on an anti-Trump message for this 2018 election. I think that Democrats should run as though history isn't on their side, even though it is, when it comes to sort of the out party having success in a midterm election. And I think that the most important thing for them is just going to be to recruit quality candidates. It sounds like there's a great number of people who are already registered to run in these various districts. It's going to be important to have candidates that fit the districts. It's going to be important that each candidate, has a message that is localized and fits the place where they're running. I have to say, I think that they'll manage to walk and chew gum, as many people said to me when I reported my article.
Graham, thank you so much for joining us. That was Graham Weiss. He's a staff writer covering politics for The New Republic, and he joined us there to talk about the new message for Democrats in 2018. It's called A Better Deal, and why he says, they might not need that message. It's high summer. In other words, it's spider season. And I've got Central Time producer and super psyched spider fan with us now in the studio, Amanda Magnus. Hello.
Hey.
Well, Amanda, you have been in many ways the pioneer of all things spidery on Central Time. When you noticed one year, you thought there was an unusual proliferation of spiders everywhere in Wisconsin, and you hadn't really seen that before. And you booked some incredible interviews about spiders, and now you're kind of taking it pro. You're starting to go on spider walks.
Yeah, so this is something I just experimented with last night. My partner and I went for a walk around our neighborhood, and we just looked around to see what kind of spiders we could see. And there are so many, and there are so many different kinds. If you just like walk with your eyes on, you know, to the side of you, what's happening with the buildings that you're walking by, just in all the corners and crevices and by the lights, it's really cool what you can find just like in your own backyard.
What was the coolest spider you saw last night?
We saw a giant spider. I don't even know what it was, but we got to see him eat or her. Eat a bug that had just like been caught in the web. That's the benefit of doing it after dark. Go towards a light where all the bugs are attracted to. You'll see a web and maybe you'll get to see a spider in action.
So you don't have like a spider field guide to identify the spiders. Not yet anyway.
Not yet, Veronica.
Well, that's why you'll be producing, I think, more spider segments here on Central Time. Are you seeing spiders out there? Maybe a lot of them. Do you like them? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.